Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, United States v. Sriram. Mr. Weissman.
May it please the court. The district court erred in reaching a loss amount in this case. The district court's errors were both of legal and factual nature. Legally, the district court misapprehended the meaning of loss. In his plea colloquy, the defendant admitted to submitting fraudulent claims to Medicare, admitted to receiving substantial payments as a result of those fraudulent claims.
But wasn't it the government's burden at sentencing to come up with a reliable number quantifying that loss? He wasn't saying it was zero. I mean, I know, I realize compared to what the government was saying, he was saying it was close to zero, but he was not saying it was zero.
That's correct. He admitted, though, to receiving substantial payments. The government's burden is to prove a reasonable estimate of the loss amount.
Right, and isn't that the whole problem, though, that the district court thought that the evidence the government submitted was not sufficiently reliable to carry its burden of proof?
And yes, Your Honor, that is the issue, and the government believes that determination was erroneous. From a factual basis, the district court found that there were potential claims that had been double-counted or potential cross-claims. In fact, those errors were quantifiable. The double counting, the government, as a sentencing hearing exposed, the government tried to weed out as many double claims as it could. The defendant's expert said that there was a potential for additional double counting, yet he identified and quantified those double counting claims. So that basis for tossing out the government's data was not a valid basis. It was a quantifiable error, so to speak. The second issue that the district court found problematic was that there were...
So let me ask you, what exactly do you want? What do you want from us exactly? Do you want us to specify some lost sum, or do you want...
No, Your Honor. The government's asking that this case be remanded to the district court, but I do think...
Would that be for a further evidentiary hearing or just reconsideration with the existing sentencing record, or what?
I think that this court needs to further explain to the district court what the meaning of loss is.
My question: Do you want an opportunity to provide, you know, better evidence, a better witness, or do you just want the judge to re-examine the issue?
Judge, I think there's a sufficient factual basis for the district court to make a loss finding. The government,
but I don't understand what it is you think the legal error on loss was. I really understood the district court simply to be disagreeing that you would come up with evidence that was good enough to show the quantification of that loss. And so he stuck with the $1,258 that appeared in the two fraud counts.
I think that issue is really at the heart of what went wrong in the district court.
But that's not a legal issue. That's a factual issue.
Your Honor, I believe it's a legal issue in the sense that when a claim is submitted by the defendant and the defendant does not know that claim to be accurate, the loss occurred at that time. That was a problem. The defendant admitted in his plea colloquy that he did submit fraudulent claims.
But you're equating fraud with negligence now, aren't you?
No, Your Honor, because, first of all, the defendant admitted to knowingly submitting fraudulent claims. So the issue of a mental state is answered by his plea admissions.
I thought your argument was that the judge was clearly erroneous in his treatment of the evidence of loss, right? There were errors by your expert. Your expert wasn't very good, but you say those errors couldn't possibly have depressed the loss estimate down to the $1,200 or $1,400, right? Isn't that what you're arguing? So my question is, I thought you thought that no reasonable trier of fact could go below $1,400,000.
That's not our position, Your Honor.
What is your position?
To answer your first part of that question, we do believe there is a factual error, clear that the district court was clearly erroneous.
Let's say, for example, that the error by your expert is 10%, right?
That's
no?
I'm not sure what you mean by 10%.
Well, I thought you said 10%. You know, you take the double counting
The cross claims,
you know, just for his errors, and I thought you said that would reduce his loss estimate by 10%.
We, in our brief, Your Honor, we set forth assuming certain parameters, that every claim that was submitted actually a double count. So you reduce that, and then you
So what is the figure that's generated by those adjustments?
$1.4 million.
So why aren't you arguing that that's the minimum that a reasonable trier of fact could determine to be the loss?
We believe that example shows why the
I don't understand you. Why aren't you arguing that that is the minimum?
I think $1.4 million is at a very conservative, reasonable estimate of the loss. But I don't think it's appropriate, based on the record, to say that is at a minimum of what the loss could be.
What is the what would the judge... I don't understand you.
Well, I think in one part, Your Honor...
I
think it could be higher.
But the question
could it be lower?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is, could it be lower? In the right case, yes, it could be lower.
In the right case, in this case, could it be lower?
I don't think it should be lower.
Well, if it couldn't be lower, why are you arguing with me? My suggestion was that your position, your logical position, your implicit position is that $1.4 million is the floor. Because after you generously correct, adjust for your expert's errors, it doesn't get below $1.4 million. So.
I don't mean to be arguing with the court. I think that is a reasonable estimate. I think what I was going to say, in fairness to the district court, we never made that exact argument to the district court. I think before this court, I do think that's a reasonable more than reasonable. I think that's
what
a completely...
What is the point? If you convince us that $1.4 million is the floor, what would be the point of allowing the district judge to find a lower amount, right? Unless you think this should be open to more witnesses for a sentencing hearing.
I'm sorry for interrupting. I do not think we need more evidence at the district court level.
And given that it's your burden of proof, I don't know how you'd entitle yourself to more witnesses unless the district court had precluded you from introducing evidence that you wanted to introduce, and I don't see anything like that in this record.
As to the loss amount, I agree with you, Your Honor. I don't think we need more evidence. However, as to the violation of the judicial order, this is somewhat tangential, but the government was, I think, put at a loss or at a deficit because the defendant never contested that issue.
Well, look, on the violation of the judicial order point, I understand your argument to be that the objection that was made early on was far too vague to alert the government to the fact that the point in issue was the status of this company as an insurance company. And the minute you found that out, you furnished the evidence, and that should have been the end of it, which makes sense to me. But
right.
You don't need more evidence other than what you've already proffered at the reply stage in the district court even for that.
Although it's not clear on the record that the district court has accepted our submissions.
But you submitted it. I mean, we have it. We see what you were offering, if you will.
And I believe that that's sufficient. I don't know that the record is clear that the district court has accepted that submission. So with that one caveat, we do think that we should be able to introduce evidence if the district court hasn't accepted it, that Great West was a healthcare provider. Other than that, I think we could go back to the district court, make our arguments as to loss amount, and be able to resolve this issue. To answer your question, Judge Posner, though, we believe the $1.4 million is a very fair, conservative estimate of the reasonable loss amount. And the question, I don't know that it is this court's, this court can dictate an amount to the district court.
Well, of course it can. If we said that it would be unreasonable on this record for a district judge to find a loss amount of $1.4 million, then that would set a floor for the remand.
And I think the evidence supports our calculation.
That's why I was asking why you didn't think the $1.4 million was the floor.
I'll take that as a floor, Your Honor. I think that's a good suggestion.
Could I ask you, Mr. Weissman, how the tax fraud claim, in your view, factors into this sentencing? Stipulated loss was in excess of $550,000.
Your Honor, that is, I think, again, goes to the heart of the reasonableness of this sentence. The tax loss was never litigated, never disputed. That tax loss was a level 18 with acceptance, was level 15. I think that resulted in 24 to 30 months sentence under the advisory guideline range. That sentence alone, if you took out every other piece of litigation, was the advisory range that the district court gave probation. There's absolutely no explanation for it.
I was going to ask, I mean, your opponent suggests that somehow the district court did take into account the tax count. Where does he do that?
Well, in fairness, the district court originally in November of, in its November opinion, failed to properly group the tax fraud. The government objected to that, and at the sentencing itself, the district court did correct that error. So it did properly group or not group, as the case may be, the tax fraud with the health care fraud loss. But, again, getting back to your point, if you just took the tax fraud case alone, you would be looking at a substantial sentence of imprisonment, and the district court never, ever looked at that in coming up with a reasonable sentence under 3553 factors. That, I believe, shows why the sentence itself was unreasonable.
So they do group, in your view?
They do not group.
They do not group. Okay. So if there were a remand, there would also have to be some attention paid to the tax fraud.
Although the district court did agree with the government that they should not be grouped. So in the end, when it determined its advisory guideline range, it did not group those offenses, which was the government's view. But I think getting back to
What are the implications of that view on lost?
On the lost portion for the health care fraud, Your Honor?
What is the significance for the overall sentence? Did he get a sentence for tax fraud?
The district court looked at the sentence, but I don't think that's part of the problem of why that's...
Was he given a sentence? Was he convicted of tax? He was convicted of tax fraud?
Yes, he was, Your Honor.
Was he given a sentence?
He was given an overall sentence for both the tax fraud and the health care fraud. But the problem that the government...
You mean the probation plus the 1400 or whatever, that's for both?
For everything. And that gets to why that sentence is unreasonable. Because
what he says, probation, it's the judgment of this court that the defendant is hereby placed on probation for a term of 5 years on counts 5, 20, and 63 to run concurrently. So I read that as 5 years probation on each one of them. So in other words, yes, there is a sentence. It's the same 5 years probation,
absolutely,
but it's concurrent.
And if, just to finish up that point, if you had just looked at the tax offense alone, that would have generated an advisory guideline sentence of 18 to 24 months, taking away all the other issues that this case presented. That's why the sentence of probation is unreasonable.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Miller?
I'd like to begin by focusing on a question that Judge Wood posed, and then I'm going to move on to the Hyde Amendment claim, if I may. You asked, could the sentence be lower? And the answer is, it could absolutely be below the $1.4 million. This was a highly technical...
$1,400.
I'm sorry?
It couldn't be $1,400.
I'm sorry, $1.4 million.
It couldn't be as low as the judge thought.
Well, Your Honor, it could be.
That's ridiculous.
Your Honor...
I mean, the evidence is overwhelming. Of massive fraud.
Well,
hours alone that he claims to have worked, and these multiple visits that he made in the snow
during
and
a
all
snowstorm
this.
When no traffic could move in Chicago.
Your Honor,
it is absurd.
It's more than $1,400 for that day alone.
Well, it is,
and you don't defend the district court's rationale, which was that all services were performed, which is a hoot.
What the district court found was that the overwhelming loss evidence that the government...
It doesn't matter what's overwhelming. You don't get down to, $1,200 or $1,400.
Your Honor, the plea agreement put the burden on the government to prove using reliable evidence.
They put in a tremendous amount of evidence. Now, it's true, it's flawed evidence, and you can give a big discount, but you can't get down anywhere near to where the district judge did.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit respectfully that you can for this.
Why don't you make an argument for something other than $1,400 or $1,200?
The district court said any amount would be speculative on the continuum from $1,400
Look, counsel, is it the problem with that is it sounds like the district court was saying, I can't be sure whether the right amount is $5 million or $10 million. It's speculative to choose between these, so I'll set the right amount as zero. But if you have trouble in a range, you might pick the low end of the range, or you might pick the median of a range, but you don't pick zero.
No, because the range the government is positing with a floor of $1.5 million derives from the government's expert, who the district court chose not to credit.
Counsel,
if you look at the math.
Counsel, yeah. The most favorable approach to you is to throw out the government's expert, to throw out all the statistical evidence, and look at the loss that would be calculated wholly on the basis of the patients who showed up and described what the defendant had not done for them compared to the bills, the amount for particular days like the snowstorm day. That would be the position most favorable to you, although the district court didn't discuss it.
I'm prepared to address that. The government's proof fell into two buckets. One was the statistical data, which Judge Jarrett discounted as unreliable, and then they called a handful, under a dozen patients or caretakers, to describe the services
so
that were provided.
If you calculate the loss based on all of those individual episodes, what does it come to?
The government never submitted
You calculate the loss, what does it come to?
Your Honor, I don't know because it was never done, but these people testified. Your Honor, these people,
counsel, you can do it. You can add them all up. Have you done that?
No.
All right.
These people testified, and every one of them was shattered on cross-examination.
No, that's not true. That's not true.
Well, Judge, I can go through the names.
The woman who admitted maybe, you know, there was a visit, something like that, but not 12 visits, right?
All right, so 12 visits might be a couple hundred more dollars.
So Minnie Wallace. Well, already, when you're just dealing with $1,258, a couple hundred more dollars, if you get over $2,000 even, it's a level on the guidelines. There's Ms. Wallace. They're the dead people claims that he admits to in the plea agreement. That's a paragraph of the plea agreement.
But it wasn't.
Why isn't that evidence?
The amount is not quantified, and, again, the third-party administrator for Medicare, WPS, we submitted their testimony, and he says, and this is the government's administrator, that if there are errors as to dates of service, so long as other services were provided, this is Peter Theiler, it's not a fraudulent claim which should be denied.
But how can that apply to the people who were deceased?
Because, well, that would be a date of service issue. If services may have been provided to them while they were alive, and because of the delays in submitting the bills, he had the wrong date on that. And the government, you see, the government took this 60,000-foot view of this entire case. And at the beginning of the case, they said the only way to prove loss amount here is to do a statistical sample where we will compare bills with medical records and see if they were...
What's your response to the government's argument? If you go back to these bills and the bills themselves are fraudulent, what basis is that? Apparently only 10% of them could be verified by third-party records.
No, this is exactly why the district courts would be affirmed, because this is such a technical error. The fact that it was only 10% third-party corroboration. He was only looking for third-party corroboration to get a sense of how hard Dr. Schramm was working. If you or I go to a physician and we get an examination, the physician takes notes of what he recorded. There's no third-party record of that. So, again...
And so why is that useful if the physician writes down that he's performed 7 procedures on me and I'm unsophisticated, and in fact he's really only performed 2? How will looking at his record reveal that 5 of them were fraudulent? He submits all 7 to Wisconsin Physician Services.
What it boils down to is you have to litigate each one of those claims and determine whether or not the patient's recollection is correct.
He pleaded guilty, and I think you're confusing what needed to be shown at the guilt stage with what kind of things had to be shown at the sentencing stage for amount of loss and the ability to estimate at that sentencing stage.
Well, again, our position, and I do think it's the appropriate position here, is that the government only had the foggiest idea of what the scope of this fraud was, and they admitted as such.
Suppose that we sent it back, and the judge found that the real loss, you know, was $1 million or something like that, then you would be asking for a below guideline sentence. And I don't understand the basis on which Judge Dara went below the guidelines.
Well, it was actually quite clear. He found, these terms are somewhat archaic now, but he found that there were enormous delays in the adjudications case caused by government misconduct, including the discovery delays. There are many cases which have granted downward departures.
Wait, we don't talk about downward departures anymore.
Well, I know that, but you.
No, we're talking about a below-guideline sentence. So let's try to purge our vocabulary of downward departures.
Well, essentially what he found in so many words is Dr. Sriram, given the guidelines calculation he came up with, Dr. Sriram had suffered enough. He had been under virtual house arrest, in the court's words, for 5 years while this case played out. The delay in adjudicating the case, he found, factually, was due to government misconduct. There were allegations made about him regarding the catheterizations, which were wholly unfounded.
Why would the delay in adjudication hurt your client?
Well, his life was on hold for 5 years.
Yes, I know, but once he pleads guilty, you know, and is sentenced and so forth, especially if he's given a real sentence, most defendants like to postpone the evil day in which they are sentenced.
And I want to throw in another factor
Sure.
here. Where in 3553A, which I'm looking at, does it say this is the place to punish the government for delay in pursuing a case? I see only things about the nature and circumstances of the offense, the history and characteristics of the defendant, and these various points that the sentence should address. I don't see this as a vehicle for punishment of government misconduct.
Well, I do think it is. Look, Judge Dara had more time to evaluate this defendant than most district sentencing judges do.
But you can't rely on the government delay, because that is not a valid factor under 3553A.
Well, I think I don't have it in front of me, but isn't there something about the adequacy of the punishment there?
That's different. That is, does this man need deterrence? And if you want to talk about that, that doesn't have anything to do with government misconduct.
Well, I think what the judge was saying, and I don't think he's punishing the government. He's saying that because of the unfortunate way this case was litigated by the government, the defendant had already been punished in fact, and he saw no reason.
That's preposterous, really. This defendant would be, you know, immensely pleased to walk home with this sentence and not have it exchanged for a prison sentence.
Well, obviously he was pleased, and he would be pleased if that remains the outcome.
If the district judge thinks that the, quote, punishment that he has suffered is equivalent to prison, that is not tenable.
Well, he didn't put it in those terms, obviously.
You're putting it in those terms.
Well, I'm putting it in those terms.
Well, it's untenable whether you say it or whether he says it.
Are there any other issues with respect to sentencing, or should I briefly discuss? Obviously,
you might want to discuss the sentencing on the tax count.
Well, Judge Dara did a sentencing guidelines computation that explicitly took the tax count into consideration, and then he arrived at the ultimate guidelines calculation. So in terms of the sentence that he gave and the judgment of conviction order,
How is the loss on the tax count equal to $1,200 or zero in your estimate?
No, the loss on the tax case is equivalent to the stipulated amount in the plea agreement. That derived a sentencing guidelines range as low as 18 months, and the judge then deviated from that 18-month range. The loss amount of the case was the tax loss, which was agreed to by the parties.
A reasonable punishment for a $500,000 fraud.
Judge, there are infinite variety of criminal defendants who appear before sentencing judges, and this man, it's in the record, was slavishly devoted to serving the underprivileged.
Stole millions.
Well, I don't think he stole millions. I'll say that again. There's no evidence of that.
And jeopardized the health of quite a number of his patients.
Well,
indeed, his own defense was that he was so incompetent that he shouldn't be deemed to be a perpetrator of fraud, because instead he was just clobbering them medically rather than financially.
Well, first of all, that is a complete defense to a fraud case, if it was negligence versus fraud.
Guilty.
And he was vindicated by the district court on all allegations of medically appropriate, inappropriate procedures. So, Your Honor, when you say that...
He's still practicing.
He's not practicing right now.
Was his license pulled?
It was not pulled. The Illinois...
I believe it's been suspended.
Suspended, but not revoked. And he has since passed his card... There were, out of the panoply of medical procedures in this case, not a fraction of a percent dealt with the catheterization issue. The government's own expert witness, Dr. Littenberg, said from the file review that he did, Dr. Sriram's competency in practice of medicine as to the non-cardiac cath issues was fine. He had no, that's the government's expert, Dr. Littenberg. On the cath issues, he was completely exonerated by the judge, and the district court didn't appeal that. So, again, this is the danger here. This was an extraordinarily fact-bound and complicated scenario. Judge Jarrah spent more time looking at this issue than many federal judges do in sentencing issues. And I would urge you to give the deference to the district court judge that district court judges, as the fact finders, are entitled to. This case is of infinite factual complexity. And just... with all due respect, by the nature of the questions being asked here, it shows you, like the 10% issue, your judge, there are so many ways to go wrong here in terms of an opinion if you don't give deference to what Judge Jarrah went through.
The reply brief did not take issue with the vast majority of the government's factual arguments.
Well, Judge, the vast majority of the sentencing issue in this case.
10%. You didn't say anything about that.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, we went through the litany of methodological errors that the district court found, and we pointed out that our expert, who the court obviously credited, said that you have only had to have seen 18 patients per day to have submitted the claims at issue. That's in the record. The district court judge, I believe, needs to be given deference to the fact there's record evidence. By the way, and the government's witness was not an expert. He had no technical knowledge about billing, which, by the government's admission, is a highly technical issue. The defense expert was an expert's expert in this area, and he found there was no overbilling.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Weissman, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Thank you. Let me pick up where Mr. Miller left off. The defendant's expert did not say that there was no loss in this case. The government's brief cites to his testimony wherein he says, I'm not saying whether the work was done or not. I'm simply saying, in his opinion, Mr. Sietzma's opinion, there was sufficient time for the work to be done. This whole idea that there was no loss is a complete fiction.
But I thought in order for this work to have been done... This had to be done on a 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year basis.
Yes. In addition, Mr. Sietzma, in his calculation, includes a period of time, multiple months, I think 2 to 3 months, after the defendant's last claim to Medicare was submitted. And he says, he had this whole time period to do the work. Impossible. His last claim was submitted on this date, August 1st. He didn't have September 3rd to do work on August 1st. The date of the last submission was the last day he could have done the work. So Mr. Sietzma's testimony, while expansive, never says that all the work was done. In fact, he says specifically to the contrary. I can't tell you whether the work was done or not. I can only tell you, in my opinion, there was sufficient time. And I just want to raise one other issue, which is the mens rea issue, whether this was negligence or intentional fraud. The defendant admitted to an intentional fraud. He pled guilty to such. His conduct was reckless.
But my question on that is, yes, he pleads guilty to that, but then when we get into the sentencing phase, isn't it possible that some of the submissions that he made to Wisconsin Physician Services were the product of that intentional fraud, and some other submissions he made might have been merely negligent? And some of them may have been correct. Some of them may have been both correct and not negligent and not fraudulent. And didn't the government have to separate out those that were the that were fraudulent?
And, Your Honor, the answer to your question is yes. If I may have some more time just to answer your question. The answer to your question is yes. It is possible. One, however, the defendant never presented evidence saying, okay, all these dead patients I filed claims for treating, the reason I made that mistake is I did X. I was treating the wife, not the husband, and I used the wrong patient. That might explain some of it, but there's no evidence like that. Or the claims for the days when there was bad weather, and he said, oh, the reason because of that is I used the wrong date. I used the date I was submitting the claim, not the date I provided service. Nothing like that. There's none of that. So is it possible? Yes. There's no evidence to support that possibility. As to the second issue, the government does need to give him credit for work that he's done, and that's why in our analysis we gave him credit for working 80 hours face-to-face with patients a week. That gave him credit for work done. Even with that very beneficial view of the evidence, there was still a multimillion dollar loss.
How old is he?
I'm sorry?
How old is he?
The defendant?
Yeah.
You know, Your Honor, I don't know off the top of my head. I know he's relatively young. I'm sorry?
Young or middle-aged?
I'd say relatively.
Talking about the 80 hours.
Relatively young. I think he's in his late 40s or early 50s. So. If there are no other questions, the government would ask that this court remand this case to the district court with direction that the $1.4 million loss amount is the floor of a reasonable loss amount and affirm the court's ruling regarding the Hyde Amendment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel.